Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Now, therefore, you are hereby ordered, commanded, and required to execute the said sentence upon him, the said William Kimmler, otherwise called John Hort, upon some day within the week commencing on Monday, the 24th day of June, in the year of our Lord, 1889, and within the walls of Auburn State Prison, or within the yard or enclosure adjoining thereto, by then and there causing to pass through the body of him, the said William Kimmler, otherwise called John Hort, a current of electricity of sufficient intensity to cause death, and that the application of such current of electricity be continued until he, the said William Kimmler, otherwise called John Hort, be dead.
Gentlemen, I wish you all good luck. I believe I'm going to a good place, and I'm ready to go. I only want to say that a great deal has been said about me that is untrue. I'm bad enough. It is cruel to make me out worse.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And those were a couple of quotes concerning the death of one William Kimmler, the first person in the world ever to be legally executed by electric chair.
That's right. This was 1889. And as we'll roll out in these episodes this week on electricity, on the sort of the weird history of electricity, this electric execution kind of serves as like the final thrashing moment for the mysticism of electricity, the sort of supernatural zeal that surrounded it for so long.
I remember when I was growing up and I learned that the Constitution of the United States prohibited cruel and unusual punishment of criminals. And then I tried to reconcile that with the fact that people were executed by electric chair. It was just hard to think of a stranger way to kill somebody on purpose.
Yeah, and I think that will become clear to everyone, especially in the second episode when we get into the details of this about how this came to be on the table, how the argument was made that we should electrocute a prisoner, why it was a good idea, and why it was the most modern and humane and hygienic thing to do.
Yeah, so this is going to be the first part of a two-part series on the weird history of electricity, as we've said. And we want to focus on a different side of the story of electricity than you probably learned about in school. So you've probably learned about things like some of Benjamin Franklin's experiments and how the battery was invented and the voltaic pile and eventually Thomas Edison and maybe if your teacher was pretty cool, Nikola Tesla and the current wars and stuff like that. But we want to look at a different side of how electricity came to be a fixture of our society today, and not just the technological journey, but the spiritual journey.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you want more on that technical journey, do go to howstuffworks.com and check out the article How Electricity Works. That's by Marshall Brain, William Harris, and me to a very limited extent. I think I touched up that article at one point, but mostly it's Brain and Harris that can be thanked for that article. But
did you have to add updates, all the new things we've discovered about electricity in the past few years?
I think I basically did punch up on it in the same way that a comedian might punch up a script. I like went in there and made it a little more fun at the beginning and updated the references, but otherwise left all the technical information as is. But yeah, this is about sort of the spiritual journey of electricity, the cultural journey of electricity from the realm of the magical to the realm of the mundane.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was thinking about these episodes, actually this morning in the shower and on the drive into work, I kept thinking of it in terms of a transformer. Okay. Like you see, with high tension wires.
Yeah.
So the times, experiments, and thoughts that we're going to present in this pair of podcasts, they serve as a sort of transformer. So a transformer decreases the voltage of alternating current, turning a dangerous high voltage current that's capable of traveling long distances into a lower voltage current that's appropriate for just mundane use in your home. So these events that we're going to discuss are the inner workings of the cultural transformer that transformed electricity from a magical, holy, spiritual, otherworldly energy into something that you can just completely take for granted every day of your life.
Okay, well, let's go back in time from the execution of William Kimmler and go all the way back to the earliest things we know about electricity. Because before humans began to recognize and test electromagnetism as a force of physics, we were aware of it in several natural settings. For example, lightning. That's pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. The shocks of electric fishes and objects that naturally pulled toward one another through some invisible attraction. So you might have a lodestone or, the name for magnetite, or you might find that friction, we're just rubbing one object against another could cause attraction. And before we had even the slightest idea what electricity was, its power found a way into our metaphors. We naturally recognized that there was something very mysterious and important going on in these invisible forces. So, for example, in Plato's Meno dialogue, you remember this one, the Meno, he compares Socrates' style of argument to a torpedo ray, which it's a type of electric fish. It's a genus of a ray that stuns prey and enemies with jolts of electric charge issued through the water. And the point of the comparison is that Socrates stuns his interlocutors into a state of just utter perplexity by illuminating the aporia, the realization of an internal contradiction in one's worldview.
Okay. In other words, he's dropping truth bombs.
Exactly.
He's stunning you with his truth bombs.
That's a very similar metaphor, I'd say, except they wouldn't say truth bombs because they didn't have bombs, but they did have electric fish.
There you go.
So he's dropping truth torpedo fish.
Okay. And just an aside, there are numerous electric fish out there. The electric eel, which is more of an electric catfish, tends to get most of the press because it is the most electric fish.
Uh-huh.
But there are varying levels of electric fish out there, ranging from those that stun their prey to those that use it as more of a communication sensory scenario.
Yeah.
And then there's Thales of Miletus. So this is a Greek philosopher known as one of the legendary seven wise men. And he may have been the first human to really study electricity. And this would have been around 600 BCE.
Now, he was the one who was doing friction experiments,
yes.
Right?
He would take amber, so, you know, fossilized tree resin.
The stuff from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully there's an insect in there, kind of, you know, crippled and frozen in time.
But he didn't come up with the idea to get its DNA out.
No, he wasn't quite up to that level. Unless you want to view the resulting spark here as like the soul of the bug leaving the amber. So he'd rub the amber with fur, and he was able to attract dust, feathers, and other lightweight objects. And so these were the first experiments with electrostatics, the study of stationary electric charges or static electricity. In fact, the word electricity comes from the Greek electron, which means amber.
Yeah, and what else the ancients knew about electricity, it's hard to know. There is, of course, the quite famous Baghdad battery, which I think most archaeologists now think was not actually a battery. But mm-hmm. The idea there was that there was a clay jar, and then found near it were some metal elements that, if arranged in the right way, perhaps could have accumulated electric charge. I've read that archaeologists now just almost all agree that it was just a normal, ordinary storage jar. It was not actually a battery, but one could hope, you know, you always kind of think, wouldn't it be cool if there was some ancient person who had knowledge way ahead of their time and it was just lost to history because I don't know, they didn't write it down or nobody would believe them. But people recognized there was a force at work. There was electromagnetic attraction, there was static discharge, shocks, sparks, arcs, but what was it? People commonly spoke about it using sort of familiar but vague or incorrect points of comparison, like Benjamin Franklin in his letters and notes in the mid-1700s spoke of the electrical fire. This was a common point mm-hmm. of comparison. People would speak of the fire that carries the electrical fluid. Or even in 1889, so much later, Thomas Edison, who worked with electricity in a technological sense, he could command electricity to do his bidding. Yet when asked what it was, he vaguely explained that electricity was a mode of motion, a system of vibrations.
Yeah, I love this quote because apparently Edison was just out there pressing the flesh. It was like a formal engagement. Yeah.
I think he was having lunch with somebody at the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, and then somebody asked him, so Edison, the electricity is your thing. Tell me, what is it? And
blah, blah, blah.
This is all he could really come up with.
Yeah, and so even after people were performing experiments with electricity, even creating some electrical technologies that they were using for purposes in say medicine, whether or not those purposes were quite on the money in terms of improving people's health, people mm-hmm. were using electricity, but they didn't know what it was. Even in 1767, after a lot of these famous experiments like Benjamin Franklin's experiments, Joseph Priestley described electricity as the youngest daughter of the sciences, which I think is kind of a sweet thing to say. But what was the invisible fire? The electrical fire, it was a natural force of the world, people understood, and yet it commanded a sense of mystery because it was invisible most of the time. It could act at a distance like a ghostly force almost. You know, the attraction between objects could be mm-hmm. like a ghost reaching out through the ether to pull things toward one another. It could spark in the dark. And these were strange and mysterious phenomena. Even when people began to be able to control it, they didn't know what it was. So the modern era of electrical research, I think, is often traced back to the creation of the Leyden jar, right? So the Leyden jar was a thing that was invented in the 1740s, usually cited as 1745 or 46, discovered independently by different people at different times. But the Leyden jar was what was then known as a condenser, but it's what we'd now call a capacitor. So in simple terms, this is a device capable of storing and quickly discharging a large amount of electricity.
Yeah, I've read the Leyden jar, particularly the one that was created by Dutch instrument makers Edward van Kleist and Peter van Musenbroek, that this was basically a glass jar full of water and had a nail in it. And this mm-hmm. they were able to use this to store an electrical charge.
Yeah, they had different metals on the inside and outside, and the differential between them could allow electric charge to accumulate, and then mm-hmm. you could discharge it.
Yeah, and pretty massively. Like, apparently, the first time Musenbroek used the jar, he basically shocked the hell out of himself. I mean, didn't die, but tremendous amount of shock coming out of this jar of water and nail.
Well, but once you look at what this kind of jar is capable of, delivering a shock like that, mm-hmm. obviously some applications could come to mind. Yes. And they sure did come to some minds, especially the mind of one Benjamin Franklin. So you might know about some of Benjamin Franklin's experiments with electricity. Probably the most famous story is one we only have secondhand, actually, and that's the story about Franklin flying a kite tied to a key in a thunderstorm to demonstrate the electrical nature of lightning.
You that's know, right. We only have Ben and Me, that Disney cartoon, to really go by.
I don't know what that is.
Really?
What is
they did a whole cartoon about Benjamin Franklin and the kite, but there's this mouse that's really the brilliance behind Ben, and he's constantly urging Ben on. I mean, just in the Ben Franklin activities that are acceptable for children to watch.
You know, I think this story was propaganda invented by the kite makers lobby. No, but seriously, so we don't know if this story actually happened or not. It probably did. We get the story from Franklin's friend, Joseph Priestley, who reported it later, so not from Franklin himself. But Franklin certainly did do lots of experiments on electricity. He invented the lightning rod, which is a rod mounted on top of a building that's connected to a wire leading down to a ground rod embedded in the earth. And what this does is it gives the lightning an avenue of travel from the top of the building to the ground, sort of a harmless path, rather than it going through the building, starting fires, potentially damaging people or structural elements.
Yeah, it's like the expressway going around a major population center so that the traffic doesn't have to go directly through town where it can cause all sorts of havoc.
Yeah, so you've probably heard about these things, but you might not have heard about Franklin's experiments in the electric slaughter of large fowl.
Ah, specifically the turkey, which I do want to just throw in really quickly that Franklin famously said that that he thought the turkey should be the national bird,
yeah,
as opposed to the eagle.
A lot of thanks he gives it. He's like, national bird, you will die.
Yeah, why? Well, you would think he would maybe go out and shock the eagle, since he saw the eagle as this kind of horrible, morally offensive bird, as opposed to the noble, slightly vain and preposterous, but courageous turkey.
Yeah. Well, he did see the eagle as a thief and a scavenger, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, that's really not in our spirit. It should be the turkey.
Well, I guess there's no law that says don't kill what you believe is noble, because he believed the turkey to be noble, but he also wanted to roast it with electrical current and eat its flesh.
Well, I guess it's easier to obtain a turkey than an eagle.
That's true. The eagles fight back. Yeah. So on April 29th, 1749, Franklin wrote to the scientist Peter Collinson a letter detailing the results of some recent experiments he'd done in electricity. And he ended with a strange proposal for a, quote, party of pleasure on the banks of the Schuylkill, the river. And so this is what he said, quote, "A turkey is to be killed for our dinners by the electric shock and roasted by the electric jack before a fire kindled by the electric bottle, when the healths of all the famous electricians in England, France, and Germany are to be drank in electrified bumpers under the discharge of guns from the electric battery."
Okay, first of all, what's an electric bumper?
This is great. So Franklin explains this in a marginal note. He says, "An electrified bumper is a small, thin glass tumbler near filled with wine and electrified.
Whoa.
This, when brought to the lips, gives a shock if the party be close shaved and does not breathe on the liquor."
How is that not factoring into modern mixology? That you think that would, I could see that going over huge at trendy bars, right?
Like especially
glass.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it would really go with the, you know, those trends in the the 50s where they'd have electric movie seats that would shock you during
horror
movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they should have served drinks that would shock you as well.
Huh.
So anyway, Franklin's attempt to slaughter turkeys with the electric discharge of Leyden jars, which is what he was using, the Leyden jars we talked about earlier, those were his electric bottles. This happened in 1750, and it did not go so well, according to a letter from one William Watson to the Royal Society in London. Quote, "He first made several attempts on fowls and found that two large thin glass jars gilt, holding each about 6 gallons, and such as I mentioned I had employed in the last paper I laid before you upon this subject, were sufficient when fully charged to kill common hens outright, but the turkeys, though thrown into violent convulsions and then lying as dead for some minutes, would recover in less than a quarter of an hour." Ah. So they had turkeys coming back from the dead. I mean, that's pretty messed up. Watson continues, "However, having added 3 other such to the former 2, and he's talking about the Leyden jars there, Though not fully charged, he killed a turkey of about 10 pounds weight and believes they would have killed a much larger. He conceded, as himself says, that the birds killed in this manner eat uncommonly tender.
You know, that's one heck of a Yelp review. But but I do appreciate the spirit of the thing. The spirit of the dinner was, we're just going to have a completely electric dinner. Everything from the death of the bird to the cooking of the bird to the curious way that the drinks make your lips tingle. Uh-huh. Everything is going to be powered by this divine energy that we are now harnessing with our modern science.
Well, it almost sounds like the scientific counterpart to those spirit parties people would have, where, you know, where you'd have a seance and you'd have people doing all kinds of spiritualist games and demonstrations. Here, it's the other side of the coin, but they're using natural phenomena. Yeah. Though then again, how natural? Because all these mysteries remained. What is the electrical fire?
Like, ultimately, they're playing with something that they don't completely understand. You know, now with that, I have to add the caveat that a lot of us today do not really completely understand the electricity that we're employing.
Right. We're fine to let it power our toaster ovens and cook our Eggo waffles, but we couldn't engineer electrical dynamos ourselves.
Exactly. And of course, that's just part of modern life. And then it should also be stressed as well that we haven't completely filled in all the blanks, all the spaces in our understanding of electricity itself.
Which is kind of weird to imagine.
Yeah, yeah. But back to the dinner party. How did our host recover from this setback of reanimated turkeys?
Well, yeah, you might think that the turkeys coming back from the dead would be enough to stun you into silence, but Franklin was in for another shock because he actually managed to shock himself so bad that he was knocked unconscious.
Oh.
Watson writes later in this same letter that he says, "From this experiment may be seen the danger, even under the greatest caution, to the operator when making these experiments with large jars. For it is not to be doubted but that several of these fully charged would as certainly, by increasing them in proportion to the size, kill a man as they before did the turkey."
Hmm. All right. So here we see the two sides of the coin. Like, on one hand, electricity can be managed. It can be used. It can be played with. But it can also prove dangerous. In high enough quantities.
Certainly. And indeed, electricity experiments could prove deadly if proper care was not taken. I want to look at one example, which is Georg Wilhelm Rickman. So he was a scientist. He was experimenting on electricity. He was conducting an experiment involving an insulated lightning rod during a storm in St. Petersburg in 1753. And Rickman got dead. He was struck dead in his lab by what has been described as a burst of ball lightning. I want to read out the account here, which is bizarre and fascinating. So this is a letter to the Pennsylvania Gazette from March 1754 explaining what happened to Rickman. It says, "The place for the experiment was a kind of gallery with its entrance toward the north and a window toward the south. Whether the window was open is not known. All that is certain is that near the window was a cupboard 4 feet long on which were placed the electrical needle and a vessel of water, partly filled with brass filings, over which came an iron bar about an inch thick and a foot long, fastened at the top to a wire which came down from the roof of the house through the gallery door." So they were sort of playing with death here. They're saying, okay, we've got a lightning rod on the top of the house. We've got it running down to an insulated wire in the room that's suspended over this bowl. And so they continue, "The professor, judging from the needle that the tempest was at a great distance, assured Mr. Sokolow that there was no danger, but that there might be at the approach." So they don't think the storm's hit yet.
Okay.
But Mr. Rickman stood about a foot from the bar, attentively observing the needle. Soon after Mr. Sokolow saw the machine being untouched, a globe of blue and whitish fire, about 4 inches in diameter, dart from the bar against Mr. Rickman's forehead, who fell backwards without the least outcry, which is a creepy way to die, right? You'd expect a person to scream.
Yeah.
Instead, he just silently falls.
Right. And then this is important to keep in mind later, this sort of accidental electrical death, where death is just instantaneous, seemingly.
Seemingly,
yeah.
Which is the scariest part based on what we finally found out can happen. But also toward the end of the same letter, what is the takeaway from this? Well, they learned some interesting things. Quote, The new doctrine of lightning is, however, confirmed by this unhappy accident, and many lives may hereafter be saved by the practice it teaches. Mr. Rickman, being about to make experiments in the matter of lightning, had supported his rod and wires with electrics per se, which cut off their communication with the earth, and himself standing too near where the wire terminated, helped with his body to complete that communication. So he formed the road. Instead of Franklin's model, where the electric current takes the freeway bypass around the city, this went straight through the city and through a dude to the other side.
Basically through his living room. All right, so based on that, you might think, well, surely everyone's learning the lesson here. Electricity is dangerous. You should not employ it at your dinner parties. You should not employ it in your parlor. And yet, we see the trend go in the opposite direction.
Yeah, exactly the opposite way. So that was 1753 that happened to Rickman. And at the same time, in the salons and galleries of Europe and North America, electricity was becoming the hottest bit of edutainment that there had ever been. So I want to draw now mostly from a paper called Sparks in the Dark, The Attraction of Electricity in the 18th Century by Paola Bertucci. And she's been a really good source for us in these episodes. Several of her papers have been big sources of our research. She's done a lot of work on the history of electricity, and these papers are great reads.
Yeah, we'll make sure to link out to some of her materials on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com because she seems to be one of the forefront researchers and historians on the history of electricity.
Yeah, so coming back to these sparking salons. So in the Enlightenment climate of 18th century Europe, public demonstrations of electrical phenomena and experiments became really popular forms of entertainment among the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So if you walked into a Parisian salon in the mid-1700s, you might find a horde of socialites sitting silent in the dark, watching a lecturer on natural philosophy charge an orb hanging atop a spike until it glowed, or they might give an audience member shocks of static electricity. And another funny thing you might see would be Benjamin Franklin sitting in the audience, as this was his scene. this was like the DC punk scene.
Yeah.
But the Paris electricity scene.
Yeah.
It's that much a scene.
One of the scenes that Franklin frequented, in the city.
Okay, but so it was during the 1740s that the educated audiences in Europe and North America really became familiar with the power of the electric fire. And it wasn't just Benjamin Franklin and his inner circle that were showing off all the sparkling experiments. There was a whole generation of what Bertucci calls itinerant lecturers, which is great because that makes me think of itinerant priests or itinerant evangelists.
Uh-huh.
Traveling around spreading the gospel message, except in this case, this is the electricity gospel. So they would tour from place to place, giving demonstrations in an early incarnation of what we might call edutainment, I would say. They would show off some sparks, show off some electromagnetic attraction, and they'd say, "Are you not edutained?"
Well, what are some examples of some of the demonstrations that they would roll out for the edutainment hungry population?
Right. So one would be having somebody touch an electrical apparatus, and then you'd see their hair rise up, or you could see somebody become electrically charged and then attract small objects with one's hands. Or you could use electrostatic induction to make objects move, for example, maybe making bells ring or something. Or you could darken the room and show sparks jumping between objects or electroluminescent glowing inside glass containers.
Now, the great thing about this, I imagine a lot of people are thinking this, and from a modern perspective, you think of Mr. Wizard, you think of various science shows. For me, I think
Beekman.
For me, I'm also reminded of the sort of street festival they have for the World Science Festival in New York City every year, where kids go around, they go to different science booths, and there's always at least one where they have some sort of electrical experiment going on. I mean, electrical experiments lend themselves so well to public lectures and public displays, and we're still into them to this day.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's important to notice how much of this was just spectacle. I don't know how much the average person was learning from these demonstrations in the salons, especially given how little the people lecturing probably knew about electricity. Like we said, they didn't know about electrons yet.
Right.
We didn't know what the electrical fire was. There were a lot of suppositions, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny to imagine the level of confidence in the display and the spectacle of it versus what was actually probably misinformation being communicated to people. So the demonstrations really played to the senses. They had flashes of light, crackling noises, smells, even sometimes like a sulfurous smell in the aftermath of things. A couple of examples of people who would give these things. One was Jean-Antoine Nollet, who was a French physicist and instrument maker, and he would arrange experiments with chains of people holding hands who would be shocked in unison. As the person at one end of the chain touched the rod or the inner surface of the Leyden jar, and the person at the other end touched the outer surface. And there's something almost weirdly orgiastic about this, isn't there?
Yeah, well, it reminds me of these scenes of seances taking place more or less around the same time.
Hold hands in a circle, yeah.
Yeah, and all of this also reminds me of magic tricks, except in this case, the magic is real. I mean, the magic is a natural phenomenon that we don't have, at this point, we don't have all the answers for, and thus still retains a lot of its magical qualities.
Yeah, yeah. So as much as these lecturers probably wanted to emphasize the scientific and natural nature of the electrical phenomena people were observing, there is undoubtedly a very spiritual power to what people were experiencing at these mm-hmm. demonstrations, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple other things that might be showed off. One thing was medical electricity began to emerge in this period in the mid 1700s as the sort of useful incarnation of this force, which, I mean, that's funny to imagine back then. Though the medical utility of the electrical fire was still debated, demonstrators began in this period to definitely offer therapeutic electrical shocks to people who sought them for, I guess, primarily conditions of the nerves.
Yeah, I mean, here's this electricity that has this kind of magical quality to it already. Mm-hmm. You're definitely going to feel it. So you wrap a little bit of healing hocus pocus language around it, and you have yourselves potentially one heck of a placebo there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so there were a couple other things that Bertucci mentions that were often showed off. There were thunder houses and the Aurora flask. I love the idea of a thunder house. It was basically a demonstration that was sort of an ad for the lightning rod because it was a model house. So imagine a dollhouse, then with a lightning rod sticking out the top of it. Then the demonstrators would shock the house with electrical discharge. And if the rod was properly grounded, nothing would happen. But if the rod was ungrounded, a shock to the house would ignite gunpowder planted inside the dollhouse and cause an explosion. And then also there was a thing called the Aurora flask, which was a pear-shaped glass bulb designed to simulate the luminous display of the Aurora Borealis inside a container.
Huh.
So that's a weird way that we could put this amazingly beautiful, vast, natural display inside a bottle, which is almost a metaphor for what these people were doing. You know, they were taking the most powerful and mysterious, huge, grand forces of nature and capturing it and putting it in a bottle that you could look into and tap on the glass.
Yeah, lightning in a bottle. And then all the way to our modern time where what is a light bulb, but another form of lightning in a bottle and yet the most mundane thing imaginable.
Yeah. And I think partly because of all these demonstrations, people began to think of electricity as sort of the embodiment of all the force of the cosmos. So in the second half of the 18th century, people were beginning to explain all kinds of natural forces through the electrical fire. So obviously lightning and thunder, but people started to say, well, earthquakes, that's probably electricity too. tornadoes, whirlpools, it's all electricity. And Bertucci says, quote, such demonstrations contributed to the construction of an electrical cosmos, health, sickness, thunderstorm, earthquakes, and aurora borealis all resulted from the motions of the electrical fire. Again, taking on what sounds like kind of a spiritual aspect.
Yeah.
It's almost like the power and love of God that controls the motions of all the spheres.
Yeah, the sense that they're tapping into this hidden network of energy that underlies all things. The kind of thing that I've seen discussed in various, occult or sort of spiritual papers where they're talking about, say, like there being a chaos matrix beneath reality. And if you can tap into that chaos matrix, then you have chaos magic at your disposal. Like this this is as if one were suddenly saying, hey, we found the chaos matrix and we can make the chaos magic fly from the tips of our fingers.
Now, what is the D&D alignment of the electrical phantom? Is it chaotic evil or chaotic neutral?
I think chaotic neutral. Yeah. It all depends on how you engage with it.
Okay, now we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about one of the weirdest demonstrations of the electrical fire.
Hey, everybody, you know the importance of having a quality, professional-looking website out there today. I mean, that's how you represent yourself to everybody, and you want it to look sharp, you want it to be easy to use, but you also don't want to completely break your brain or have to learn some sort of new code in order to build the thing.
Right. If you just kind of go out there into the wild and say, hey, I'm going to make my own personal website, you know what you're going to end up with. It's going to look like it was made by somebody who didn't know what they were doing. And even to get to that point, it's going to be a rough journey. But if you want to have a website that looks like something that could have been made by a professional web developer, even though you're not, you might want to think about Squarespace.
That's right. Their sites look professionally designed regardless of your skill level. You don't need to learn any code. The tools are intuitive, easy to use, and hey, you get a free domain if you sign up for a year.
So you can start your free trial site today at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code MINDBLOWN. That's our code, MINDBLOWN, to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. You should. All right, we're back.
Yes. So we're going to discuss here the work of one Stephen Gray.
Now, Stephen Gray did plenty of experiments in electricity, right?
Yes. Yeah, he was an English dyer, the son of a dyer. He was an astronomer and indeed an electrical conduction pioneer. He's remembered for a number of discoveries, and the experiments he conducted, showed how electricity moves. But the most notable of these is his 1731 experiment, The Hanging Boy.
That's a creepy name.
It is. And you can, we'll try to include some links to some images of this because there's some wonderful, schematics for what this looked like, which still don't capture the full majesty of what, people saw. Because it really resonates with occult dramatics.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's like something out of a Ken Russell movie.
I love that you make that comparison, because Ken Russell really captures this kind of sense of the electrical demonstrations, right? This, this bizarre intersection of the magical and the scientific.
Yeah, totally. So I'm going to try and present it to you, as if you were showing up for a presentation of The Hanging Boy.
Wait, so you're saying I've accepted an invitation to come view The Hanging Boy?
Yes, yes.
I'm that kind of person.
You are. You're one of the local, you're in the local science community, you're interested in this kind of thing, there's something cool going on, so you're gonna go check it out. So you enter the private home of another upstanding member of the scientific community.
Okay.
And you come and you find that the furniture's been rearranged, the lighting has been dimmed, and everyone is gathered in the largest room of the house for this very peculiar experiment. So you've been looking forward to it for weeks.
You're making a lot of assumptions about me and my feelings toward The Hanging Boy.
This is the biggest thing. This was a hit all over Europe. This is like finally getting to see Cats or something, right?
Okay. What is it? Tell me.
Okay. So the main event here is that a 9-year-old boy, don't worry, it's just a local street urchin and they've paid him for his participation.
Uh-huh.
9-year-old boy is brought in swaddling clothes, you know, dressed essentially like Cupid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So already we're engaging, dramatic, symbolic, power here. And then he is suspended from the ceiling by silk cords.
Oh, they got to be silk cords, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, to suspend the boy with just rope would be weird and just out of keeping with the symbolic drama of the thing, right? Now, just below the boy's head, they've positioned a stand on which they've placed small light flakes of brass. While meanwhile, our friend Mr. Gray here comes over with a charged glass tube, essentially a friction generator, and he's holding this near the boy's feet.
Uh-huh.
And I'll read you a quote and this is from the letters sent from Stephen Gray to one Cromwell Mortimer. Upon the tubes being rubbed and held near his feet without touching them, the leaf brass was attracted to the boy's face with much vigor, so as to rise to the height of 8 and sometimes 10 inches.
So they were drawing pieces of brass leaf to his face.
Yes, so the boy's hanging there from the silk. He touches this electric wand to the boy's feet, and then all these flakes of metal begin to drift up, fly up from the table through the air towards his face.
Okay, what else they got?
Well, they would have the boy reach out and turn the pages of a book without physically touching it.
Okay.
Volunteers from the audience were invited to touch the boy's hand, and in doing so, they were able to turn the pages in the book with the same electrical magic, just by touching the boy's hand. And finally, the main event was the lights were dimmed, and the volunteer was asked to touch the boy's nose. And that's when, crack, a visual spark flies between the flying boy and the audience member.
Wow.
So this, I mean, the whole thing is just fabulous because there's the sense of the boy is an angel.
Yeah, but also a child sacrifice.
Exactly. There's a sense of child sacrifice. And they kind of make him the sort of a literal embodiment of electricity as a virgin, as this child that is without fault, a holy, blameless creature.
Well, there you get into something else that I think is going to be very important to talk about, because there's this mysterium, there's this great strange mystery about what the electrical fire is, there's this spiritual element to it, but then there is also a very clear emerging theme of sexuality to electricity, because one of the notes that I got from Bertucci about the hanging boy experiment was that sometimes you mentioned that he would transfer the electric fire to somebody else and they would be able to attract things. Well, she mentions that sometimes the boy transmitted the electric fire to a young girl who would attract light objects to herself. So a strangely sexual theme. There's like the passage of the thing across the sex barrier. And this wasn't the only case of sexual themes emerging in electrical demonstrations. For example, Bertucci tells us in one of her papers that the presence of women and the accentuation of sex differences became a crucial part of these electrical demonstrations in the 18th century. For example, a really popular experiment was called the Electrifying Venus.
Ooh.
Yeah. Also known as the electric kiss, which was invented by the German professor Georg Matthias Bose. And it goes like this. So you've got a beautiful lady standing on an insulated stool, and an electrical apparatus charges her body with electricity. So this would probably be like a friction generator.
Okay.
And after she's charged up, the demonstrator invites gentlemen from the audience to come up and steal a kiss from the electric Venus. Unfortunately for these amorous gentlemen, as they approached the charged Venus with their lips, they would receive a spark to the mouth, and that would drive them back and discourage further attempts.
Ha! Okay.
So imagine how exciting this must have been to, a court lady in the 1700s who was sick of the advances and sexual harassment of the aristocratic men in her circle.
They even try to kiss her and they get a shock.
Right.
Yeah.
Bertucci goes on to note.
It's like the invisible fence, except for,
exactly.
For horny aristocrats. Okay.
So Bertucci goes on to note that Bose even wrote a poem about electricity. He was kind of a showman type. He wrote a poem about electricity, which he dedicated to the Princess of Gotha and the Duchess of Brühl Kollerath, who were attendees of his demonstrations. And there's a section from the poem she quotes that says, "Once only, what temerity! I kissed Venus standing on pitch. It pained me to the quick. My lips trembled, my mouth quivered, my teeth almost broke." That's intense stuff.
Yeah.
So even the demonstrator himself, knowing the risks, could not resist an attempt to kiss the sparking Venus. But to please the fellows of the salons, they would not be entirely discouraged in their feats of electrical manliness, because for their amusement, they could wield an electrified sword and use it to ignite small quantities of liquor.
Well, all right. Well, they had that, and then to just sort of leave everybody on a good note, right?
Right. Yeah. So the psychosexual significance of electricity didn't even end there. Bose, that same guy, came up with the theory of the sexology of electric fire. And it's about as male chauvinist as you would guess. I want to quote from Bertucci, who writes, characterizing it, The male fire emitted by metals and animal bodies was unsurprisingly strong and powerful. Sparks with their crackling sound were visible manifestations of this kind of fire. The female fire, instead, was a weak luminous emanation, the kind of light that characterized the aurora borealis.
I love that because he's kind of using science to recreate Taoism. In this case, you know, the whole division of yin and yang energies defining the universe.
Oh, does that have a male-female element?
Oh, yeah, yeah. One is like the male is heat and power and strength, and the female energy is colder and more subtle, and they're opposites in the universe.
Huh. Well, that's the cosmic electric spirituality yet again.
Yeah.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So through the second half of the 18th century, there was a lot of popular thinking that associated electricity with sex, virility, and fertility. Electrical imagery showed up in erotic poetry all the time. There'd be talks about sparks and friction, and medical experts even promoted sexual health cures. I should have said experts. You couldn't hear me doing air quotes.
Yeah.
Medical quote experts promoted sexual health cures via the electrical fire. And there will be more on that when we talk about a guy named James Graham in the next episode. But there's a weird paradox emerging here with the relationship between electricity and virility and health. How come the body seems to be able to be, sort of animated by electricity in one sense? You could be sparked into action, and yet the discharge of electricity from a Leyden jar might be enough to kill you. That seems like a weird tension there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to that sort of weird Taoist interpretation of male and female energies to a certain extent.
Yeah, and so later in the 1700s, this comes to a head, I think, in the argument about the nature of animal electricity. So, like we said, there are electric fishes, and so there was some knowledge about different types of bioelectricity. But what happened in the 1780s?
Well, we had a man by the name of Luigi Galvani. All right, he was a mid-1780s Italian physician, and he
you said Italian with an Italian accent.
Well, you can't say Luigi Galvani without giving right. into it a little bit, right?
Okay.
So in one of his earlier experiments, he connected the nerves of a recently dead frog to a long metal wire and pointed it toward the sky during a thunderstorm. And then with each flash, the frog moved again as if with life.
So the twitch. Dead frog.
Yes.
And this suggests a kind of mechanical connection between the parts of the body and the electrical fire, right?
Indeed. I mean, this is where we get the term galvanism from, which refers to muscle contractions due to an electric current. Now, at the time, Galvani referred to this as animal electricity, thinking he discovered a unique form of electricity, something intrinsic to the muscle tissue. So external electricity could galvanize it, sure, but his argument was that it also possessed its own unique electricity as well.
So he was saying these were the bioelectricity and the external electricity were different types of electricity.
Exactly, yeah. You bet you had two different species of electricity to deal with here. And this didn't set well with everyone, particularly
right.
Another name that resonates with electrical history, Alessandro Volta.
You can hear the electrical terms in both of their last names,
yeah,
right? Like
yeah.
Galvanize and Volta.
Yeah, so you know that this isn't just some nobody entering the fray.
Uh-huh.
So Volta, he walks in, and he's intent on disproving animal electricity. He doesn't buy it. He asserts that the animals here in Galvani's experiments reacted to electricity produced by two different metals used to connect their nerves and muscles, and that it's not any kind of intrinsic special electricity. And this argument eventually wins over the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
Galvani conducted experiments to counter the claim, but never got very far in trying to convince anyone, and he eventually dies.
But obviously showing a connection between the workings of the human body, which still in many senses were mysterious at the time and infused with spiritual and soulish potential, with this supposedly, purely natural force like electricity, that had to cause some feelings of maybe aporia, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and certainly I don't want to imply that Galvani wasn't onto something and wasn't himself, you know, a very intelligent guy that was making some breakthroughs in our understanding of electricity.
But of course, these bioelectricity beliefs led to some pretty interesting and weird experiments, right?
Yeah, fast forward to January 1803. Convicted murderer George Forster or Foster, depending on which source you're looking at, he dies by hanging at London's Newgate Prison. And then attendants transport his body to the Royal College of Surgeons, also in London. So this in itself wasn't an uncommon practice. You have a fresh body. It's perfect for the exploration of human anatomy.
Okay.
But then they roll the corpse into a crowded operating theater where awaits Giovanni Aldini, the nephew of the late Luigi Galvani.
Ah.
Yeah. And as you would imagine, given the podcast episode here, he's waiting with a battery and some connecting rods.
Oh, good.
Yes. So you know what he's going to do.
So they've got a corpse coming in.
Yep.
He's sitting there with his battery.
Yep.
Is he twirling his mustache?
I should hope so. Maybe even with electricity. But this from the records, this is what Aldini had to say about the results here. On the first application of the arcs, the jaw began to quiver. The adjoining muscles were horribly contorted, and the left eye actually opened.
Ugh.
In the subsequent part of the process, the right hand was raised and clenched, and the legs and thighs were set in motion. It appeared to the uninformed part of the bystanders as if the wretched man was on the eve of being restored to life.
You know, and I bet for the people at the time, they didn't necessarily know that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, we know now. But yeah, at the time, we were still figuring out how electricity worked, what it did to the body. And so, less informed members of the audience, it seemed entirely possible that he might have brought this character back to life in some form.
If it's conceivable that the electricity is the soul,
mm-hmm.
is the soul that animates the flesh, and the death causes this electricity to evaporate, could you restore the soul that animates the flesh to the body by charging it back up?
Yeah, and plus if you're buying into a basic biomechanical understanding, or certainly mechanical understanding of the body,
mm-hmm.
if electricity physically animates the body, then why not the mind itself? Why not the soul? Why not the person entire? And of course, a lot of this probably instantly brings to mind images of Frankenstein, of Dr. Frankenstein bringing his creation to life.
Now, funny, I remember electricity being a big part of the movie, but when I've read the book, I don't remember much mentioning of electricity in it.
There's not a lot, but a couple of things. First of all, like the timeline works perfectly for this. So Mary Shelley's book comes out in 1818. So that's, you know, just a couple of decades in the wake. I think she would have been a small child at the time of the Georgia Foster reanimation experiment. But there's actually a portion of Frankenstein that reads as follows. Before this, I was not unacquainted with the more obvious laws of electricity. On this occasion, a man of great research in natural philosophy was with us, and excited by this catastrophe, he entered on the explanation of a theory which he had formed on the subject of electricity and galvanism, which was at once new and astonishing to me. Quote Dr. Frankenstein.
Well, as we'll mention in the next episode, Mary Shelley had more than one influence of mad science on her life, probably.
Oh, yes, yes. Because certainly, I think you can see in Frankenstein, I mean, there's a lot to say about Frankenstein. We could do a whole podcast about the cultural and scientific underpinnings of that book. But yeah, there's a lot of this new age of understanding and reason of our attempt to harness all these natural wonders with our scientific understanding. You see that in these electric experiments we've discussed. You see that in Frankenstein as well.
Okay, well, I think that's going to have to be it for our first episode, the first part of this series. We've made it from the mystery of the ancients to the strange obsession with electrical fire and the electrical cosmos of the mid and late 1700s. But in the next episode, we're going to chase that rabbit further down the
circuit.
Yeah, I think that'll be it.
Yeah. So yeah, in the next episode, electric chairs, electrical personal massage devices, electric religion. And you know, there'll be a little bit of Frankenstein, but don't worry, we'll also fit John Wesley in there as well.
And of course, the striking conclusion to the story we opened with about the first legal electrocution.
Indeed. And until then, be sure to check out StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes. You'll find blog posts, videos, links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook and Twitter. We're Blow the Mind on both of those. We're Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tumblr. Follow us there. And wherever you listen to us, give us some positive feedback there. Give us a positive review if the platform allows it. We're, of course, talking iTunes. We're talking Stitcher. We're talking Spotify. New platforms are constantly rolling out. And we're making an effort to be on all of them.
Yes, that is the easiest way for you to help the show. And if you want to get in touch with us with any feedback on this episode or other recent episodes, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Imagine you ask two people the same 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.